Hillel started his nesius about 100 years before the Churban. He was a Nasi for 40 years. When Hillel was Nifta, so we're talking about, when we talk about the Patira of Hillel, so we're talking about a period of time which is approximately 60 years before the Churban of the Beis HaMikdash. More or less, what we need to know is, as we mentioned, the Hurdis, who was an Edomite, and he was, for all practical purposes, he was the king over the Eden. He was in control over Eretz Yisrael, but he had to pay taxes to the Romans, and he lived his life trying to find favor in the eyes of the Romans. Well, after he died, his son took over, and from that situation on, in his reign, so it was also a reign of terror that he brought into Eretz Yisrael. He even went to the Romans to complain about the situation that was taking place with these Edomite rulers. And so, as a result, the Romans took away the power from Hurdis, from his son, from Hurdis' son, and turned Eretz Yisrael into a Roman colony. So until this point, Eretz Yisrael, for practical purposes, actually was under, it wasn't the control of the Romans, but it was an independent country that had to pay taxes to the Romans, although the king was an Edomite. Now, Eretz Yisrael became a Roman colony. And the representative, so to say, of the Romans had his base in Syria and in Damascus. And from there, he controlled everything that was going on in Eretz Yisrael. He set up his capital in the city of Caesarea, which was a Greek city that was built by Hurdis. And now the Romans took direct control over Eretz Yisrael. Technically, the situation didn't change much. They still went all out in order to take as much money out of Eretz Yisrael as possible, which was something that the Romans always did. However, being that the control of Eretz Yisrael came from Rome, so the policy of the Romans in general was not to get involved in, I guess, what they would consider to be the local politics of the country that they would conquer. And more or less, they would allow the country to go about its own business. So in that sense, the situation got a little bit better in Eretz Yisrael. The Sanhedrin was able to be restored in the Lishkas HaGozes. So once again, you now have a central control over Klal Yisrael through the Sanhedrin and the Lishkas HaGozes. The Nasi was, after Hillel was Nifta, so his son took over, was Shimon. But because Hillel was Nifta, he was very old, so when he was Nifta, his son Shimon was also already very old. And it's very obvious, very clear, that he was a Nasi for a very short time. And we really don't have any halachas mentioned from him in the Gemara. After Shimon was Nifta, so then the one who took over was Hillel's grandson, who was Rabbi Gamliel HaZokain, and we call him Rabbi Gamliel HaZokain because we'll have later on another Rabbi Gamliel, his grandson. So we are now talking about a tkufa, more or less, as the country was turned over to the control, the direct control of the Romans. The Nasi was Rabbi Gamliel HaZokain. Once this took place, that the Sanhedrin was restored and that Rabbi Gamliel became the Nasi, so now again the Tzdukim decide to reappear on the scene. The Tzdukim were always jealous of the fact that the Prushim, like they called them, had too much control in Eretz Yisrael, and they convinced the Romans that the position of the Kohen Gadol was a sought-after position, and if the Romans wanted to make money, so they should sell the position of Kohen Gadol. So the Romans now sort of took control of the position of Kohen Gadol and sold it again and again. Just to get an idea of how often it was sold, we're talking again 60 years before the Churban of the Beis HaMikdash. In those 60 years, there were 30 different Kohanim Gedolim. So even if the Kohen Gadol didn't die, the Romans, if they just, for whatever the reason, they decided that they wanted to give it to somebody else, maybe somebody else offered them money for the position or whatever, so they would go and they would sell the position to somebody else and make another few dollars. And so it was now in Eretz Yisrael many different families of Kohanim, who a member of their family was at one point a Kohen Gadol. They were tzedukim, wealthy people, and they bought their way into the Kohuna Gadol, so to say, and they became people in Eretz Yisrael that had now Kayach because of their wealth and because of the fact that at one point they were Kohanim Gadolim. The Gemara in Psachim, Daf Nun Zayin Amar Aleph. So the Gemara over there brings down Abishol about Butnis. Abishol ben Butnis talks about different mishpachas that we have of the Kehanim, who they brought tzaras onto the Eden. They were, again, like you'd say, prominent mishpachas in Eretz Yisrael. But the fact that they were prominent didn't do anybody any good. All they did was went to start Tzaris and Eretz Yisrael. The Romans also were very particular that there should be law and order in the countries that they were in. So there were soldiers, lav davka stationed in Eretz Yisrael or through Eretz Yisrael, but they were stationed right outside Eretz Yisrael, in this case stationed in Syria. And whenever there were huge crowds of people coming into Eretz Yisrael, so then they would make sure that the soldiers would be there in order to keep control. So during the Gimel Regolim, when Yidden came from all over, and they came from all over the world, they came into Yerushalayim, but especially from all over Eretz Yisrael, so the Romans saw to it that there should always be a large platoon of soldiers in the Beis HaMikdash, keeping control of everything that went on in Yerushalayim. Technically, the situation would have, going on in such a way, would not have been so bad, but one of the Roman who took control in Eretz Yisrael, ultimately, was a person whose name was Pontius Pilate, and he ruled for approximately 10 years. He was the one in control in Eretz Yisrael for approximately 10 years, till about 35 years before the Churban. And in his time, he was a very, very cruel person, and he went to he knew that basically Eden were people that kept law and order, that whenever was a problem, you didn't have any major problems of ganavim, of murders, of heist, whatever. So, but he wanted to instigate the people in order that he should be able to have an excuse to be cruel to the people. So at one point he put up statues in Yerushalayim of the emperor in order to anger the people. So, but what he encountered was a Yidden that had, he saw, had tremendous Mesiras Nefesh. They would just go all out in order to stop him from doing what he wanted to do. But this was the type of a person that he was. In the books, they talk about him that he was, by nature, cruel, stubborn person, and that he was overrun by bribery, robbery, insults, frequent executions without trial, and cruelty without end or limit. Well, that's the description of this Pontius Pilate. The Mishnah in Idias, Perek Zayin, Mishnah Zayin, talks about Rabbi Gamliel HaZaken, who went to Rome in order to ask of the Roman emperor that he should take him away because he was so cruel, so in Poshet et Gebet Nateva, to take him away and to put somebody else in his place. Now, one other thing that we need to mention at this time, that it was in when this person had control in Yerushalayim, that the story of Yeshu HaNoitzri, who is the father of Christianity, the what Christianity is based on, took place in this time. So, once again, we're approximately between 45 years to 35 years before the Churban of the Beis HaMikdash, and an incident took place in the Beis HaMikdash. As we mentioned, the soldiers were there because it was when they came to be at the Regel to bring the Korban Pesach. The soldiers were there. He was accused of being a revolutionary, and they took him and they crucified him, which was the Roman way of execution. And from here began the seeds of what today is known as the Christian religion. We'll talk about this a little bit more what happened in this time. Now, the Gemara in Yuma on the Lamed Tes Amud Beis talks about different things that took place starting about 40 years before the Churban of the Beis HaMikdash. Now, and we'll soon discuss this. Now, we know from the Gemara that 40 years before the Churban of the Beis HaMikdash, the Gemara brings down that there was a tremendous tzaddik who was living in Eretz Yisrael. He started fasting because he knew that the Beis HaMikdash was going to be Chorev, and so he fasted and was mispalel that the Beis HaMikdash should not be Chorev. And once again, we're going to get to him later when we talk about the Churban of the Beis HaMikdash, how Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai was looking for ways in order to heal him. But this began 40 years before the Churban of the Beis HaMikdash, in this period of time that we're talking about. So it was at this period of time that it became known, or I should say accepted, more or less, by the Gedolei Yisrael, that, unless things would drastically change, so to say, the Churban was on its way. The Gemara also says that the Sanhedrin left the Lishkas HaGozes. And the reason that they left the Lishkas HaGozes was because the lawlessness in Eretz Yisrael was so bad, because, as we mentioned, because of these the different aggression that came about, because of the rulers, these Roman rulers that were found in Eretz Yisrael, the families of these Kohanim, these ruthless Kohanim, who carried out all of these terrible things in Eretz Yisrael. So there was murders and robberies that were going on throughout the land, and the Sanhedrin did not have the power to carry out the einshim, the punishments, that if they bring a person to Bezdin and they would paskin about somebody, a psak. So there was no way that they could carry through with the psak. So therefore they left the Lishkas HaGozes. Better not to come to the Sanhedrin if the Sanhedrin had no kayach anyway. And once again, this all took place during the reign of Pontius Pilate. The Gemara in Yuma also tells us that 40 years before the Churban of the Beis HaMikdash, so different things happened that sort of startled everybody. By the Sor La'Azazel. So normally, they had the Sor La'Azazel, so they had two pieces of paper. One piece of paper said Lashem, the other people said La'Azazel, and the one that said Lashem always came up on the right hand, and this time it didn't come up on the right hand. It said that after the Sawyer went La'Azazel, so there was always a piece of cloth, a ribbon, that would turn white to show that there's kapara. But starting 40 years before the Churban, it didn't happen. It didn't turn white. And the Gemara says that the doors of the Beis HaMikdash opened by themselves. And the simon being that the enemy would easily be able to walk into the Beis HaMikdash, like the Beis HaMikdash doors flung open, almost like inviting the enemy, the Romans, into the Beis HaMikdash. At that point, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai turned to the walls and said to the Beis HaMikdash that you look like you're afraid, and I know that you're showing us that very soon there's going to bring a Churban. We know that there's going to be a Churban. So from all of these simanim, and again starting at this period of time, the Chachamim were well aware of the fact that we are in a downward trend, so to say, headed towards the Churban of the Beis HaMikdash. And by all means, the Chachamim and the Nasi especially, who are preparing themselves for the Churban. And we'll soon see what preparations were made for this Churban. As we mentioned, that governor who was in control in Eretz Yisroel, he was sent back. The Nasi went and complained. This Pontius Pilate was sent away. The Romans took him away, and they sent somebody else to control Eretz Yisroel. And at that time, the emperor who took control was a person whose name was Saius Caligula or Salagula. He became the emperor of Eretz. He became the emperor in the Roman Empire, and Memele, he was the one that was in control of Eretz Yisrael. Well, at one point he decided that he wasn't just a simple boss of a dom, but that he was he considered himself a bit of a god himself, and therefore he wanted that people should bow down to his statues, and therefore he wanted that statues should be placed all over his empire. And in every other place in his empire, really, it was no big deal, it was no big problem, because for the guy to bow down, they had so many statues and so many different avodah zarah that they were bowing down to. One more really did not make a difference, as we explained. It had nothing to do with, a belief or a commitment, Bow down, noch avodah zarah, noch avodah zarah. But the problem came about where they were eaten. So there was a problem. And, of course, this meant that there was a problem in Eretz Yisrael, a very big problem in Eretz Yisrael, because the Eden, of course, refused to bow down to the Avodah Zarah. Now, what happened in Eretz Yisrael ultimately was that, and this is something we're going to have to pick up a little bit further to discuss this a little bit more, but in Rome, there was a grandson of Hurdis, who as a child was sent to Rome because, he was being groomed for a royal position. Now, obviously, it never happened. This person's name was Agrippus. So this Agrippus grew up in Rome, and he was friends of the emperor. And all over he saw what was going on in Eretz Yisrael. All over there were Yidden that were prepared to go the Mesiras Nefesh, literally to have themselves killed, and not that there should not be this Avodah Zarah that should be put up in Eretz Yisrael. So he knew that there would be a major slaughter. This Agrippa was a good person, and so he invited the emperor to a party, and he made him a lavish party. And the emperor said, "Well, what can I, you know, how can I return you the favor?" And he says, "No, just enjoy yourself." And he enjoyed himself. And how can I return? And on until finally he insisted, "Whatever you want, I'll do for you." It was such a lavish party. And finally he said to him that he should cancel this order of having the Jews bow down to the statue. I guess he explained to him, you know, it was sort of nothing personal, but the Jews cannot bow down to the statue, and as a favor to him, he agreed, and he annulled this demand that he made, that the Eden put up a statue in Eretz Yisrael, in the Makom HaMikdash they wanted to put up in different places. And so that's how this this situation was avoided in Eretz Yisrael. And we're soon going to come back to this Agrippa, because as a result of this, what ultimately happened was is that this particular emperor, this Saligula, was assassinated, as happens very often. He was assassinated, and being that he was assassinated, there was a new emperor that took control in Eretz Yisrael, and he, as a sign of Hakaras HaTov to this Agrippa, because Agrippa was instrumental in this new emperor who we're going to meet soon in influencing the people to accept this new emperor. So as a sign of Hakaras HaTov, he gave him control over that whole Middle Eastern area, fell in there also Eretz Yisrael. So he now became the governor in Eretz Yisrael, and he was a person that was very good to the Eden. He was an Edomite, so to say. He was a grandson of Hordus, but he was a good person, a kind person. And in Eretz Yisrael, we're going to begin a tkufa of calm, and a couple of years of calm, leading up to, once again, to the Churban of the Beis HaMikdash, where you have like another 40 years or so, 35 years leading up to the Churban of the Beis HaMikdash. And in those years, it gave Gamliel HaZaken and the other Chachamim a chance to prepare themselves for the Golus that they knew was coming. We need now to discuss, though, that this order was given not only in Eretz Yisrael, but it was given throughout the Roman Empire, and included in that was Egypt. And remember, we left this go a while ago, but there was a very big yeshiv of Eden living in Alexandria in Egypt. And they insisted that the Eden that were living in Egypt should also bow down to the statue of the emperor. And this should be put into the statue of the emperor, should be put into all of the shuls, and should be put wherever the Eden came together. And this became one of the order of the time. It was a very, very difficult situation. What should the Eden living in Egypt at that time, what should they do? Now, we're going to backtrack a little bit and repeat ourselves possibly a little bit about what was going on with the Eden that were living in Egypt. And the situation was as follows. We explained that Alexandria was a tremendous city. It was the crossroads of all of the different cultures that was found in that whole, in the Roman Empire. One of the main crossroads in the Roman Empire. It was the city that was built by Alexander himself. It was a city full of knowledge. It was in Egypt, so it was a city that had, you had the influence of the Avodah Zarah, you know, the Far Eastern Avodah Zarah. It also was, had the influence of the philosophers that came out of Greece. And then you had in there Nebuch also was stuck there, the Jews. It was also a very wealthy city because it was a port city and it was a very wealthy city. And the Eden that were living in Alexandria, they became very wealthy merchants living in Egypt and in Alexandria especially, but all over in Egypt. They became very wealthy. They were owners of shipping companies. They became goldsmiths, silversmiths, and they using their wealth, they built up a beautiful community, so to say, a very high-ranking community in Egypt. And they even became very high-ranking as military officers. And they were people that were found, you know, they were very much part of the high society that was there in Alexandria. So they attended the Greek dramas. They went to listen to the Greek dramas and the play. And one thing that they did was they wanted very much to become part of the society that was there. So they worked very hard in blending together the Greek philosophy together with what they had from the Torah in order that they should be able to be Greeks and Eden and Egyptian and everything together, so they should be accepted, so to say, by everybody. And I guess this is a problem that comes up very often. And so they wrote on Jewish ethics and moral philosophies, using Greek philosophy in order to explain what they were all about. Now, as a result of all of this, so there was tremendous jealousy, especially from the lower class in Egypt, that that they turned against the Eden. They were jealous, like always happens. If we become too high profile, too successful, and on top of that, too high profile, so then the brings about a tremendous level of jealousy. There was a so-called scholar at that time. His name was Apion, and he researched what these Jews were all about. And he came to the conclusion that the Jews prayed to the head of a donkey and that they killed Greeks every year after they fattened them up. They took a Greek, they fattened them, and once a year they would go ahead and they killed them. And also he proved that, or I should say he declared that all Jews had to swear that they hate all non-Jews, especially the Greeks. And many, many other lies that that he developed and he spread. And once again, because the people were anxious to persecute the Jews, they were jealous of them. So a lot of what he said was accepted, and a lot of what he said pops up again 100 years later, 500 years later, even 1,000 and almost up to our time later. So a lot of it is starting then, at this point. There was another Egyptian historian, his name was Manetho, and one of the things that he said is that it's not true that the Jews were liberated from Egyptian bondage. No, because you have to remember the Jews living in Egypt. So, you know, it didn't look so good, the whole story that they were slaves and that they broke their way out of Egypt. So it didn't look so good for the Egyptians. So he says, no, he says the story is not true. They didn't break their way out of Egypt, but the king, Pharaoh, threw them out of Egypt because they were Mitzrayim. They had Tzaraas. They were diseased people. So that's the reason that they were thrown out. Now, what happens often is that Jews are often protected by the emperors of the countries that they're in, protected from the Hamoinam, from the rabble rousers, by the emperors. And the reason for this is because we have a way of doing business, and as we said, we were very successful business people in Alexandria also. And so we were protected by the government. And if we're talking now about the Roman government, so we were protected by the Roman government because of the fact that we brought in wealth into the country. But that's how violence normally was avoided. But now we have this situation with this new emperor who came up, and he wanted that everybody should bow down to his statue, and the Jews refused. So this there was nobody now to protect them, and now he had all of these different lies that were brought about them, about, you know, what they were all about, with these different people who taught, you know, all these stories about the Jews. So all of this coming together brought what we would call pogroms into Egypt at that time. They ransacked the homes of the Yidden, and they burnt down the shuls, and wherever they could, they put up the different statues of the emperor, of this emperor. And they did it all, you know, just to persecute the Jews. As a result, the Eden decided to send a special delegation of their noblest spokesman to Rome to sort of explain their position and try to get the emperor to retract from his position. Now, at the head of the delegation that went to Rome, representing the Jews of Alexandria, was a famous Jewish philosopher whose name was Philo. His name was Philo. And he came from one of the noblest families of Alexandria. His family was well situated in Alexandria. And Philo himself received the highest Jewish and secular education found in Egypt. And he also was one of the greatest Jewish scholars, so to say, that was found there. But you must remember, as we learned after the Torah was translated into Greek, that the situation there wasn't good at all. So even assuming that he was a big scholar, but he was missing a lot. And he was a person that was very fond of Greek philosophy, and he tried to prove that the views of Plato were in reality contained in the Torah, Rahmanul Islam. And he did this by saying that some of the things in the Torah were allegorical explanations, they were mesholim. And the ethical teachings that were found, you know, the stories of the others, and so to say. So, you know, he said that these are all allegories. And he tried, once again, to put together Greek philosophy, together what it says in the Torah. And he did this because he wanted to show that we're like everybody else, that, you know, we're no different than anybody else, and therefore you have no reason to hate us. This again, is something that somehow we never learned, that this is not why they hate us. In fact, they didn't make matters worse. But so what he did was he distorted the true meaning of the Torah, and he himself, I guess we would call him a practicing Orthodox Jew. He kept the mitzvahs, but unfortunately he helped to weaken the ganze yadus, and that he was sent in order to somehow to try to convince the emperor. Now, he wasn't successful in convincing the emperor in any way, and Shang he wrote a huge commentary on the Torah, pushing his philosophy and his way of life. And also, what we need to know is, maybe we won't go into this, but we need to know that a lot of what his writings, the fact that he said that things in the Torah were allegories or mesholim, had a great influence on the development of Christian philosophy, which is soon going to appear. So, you know, this had to do with their different people amongst the Christians who said that you didn't have to keep the mitzvahs that said in the Torah, and they said that, you know, based on this, because it's allegories, mashalim, so they didn't have to keep it, and they used it for themselves. The Christians took this and they used it for themselves. And also, he had a theory called the logos, that the world is controlled by an intermediary. And that also was something that they hooked onto, that some of them claimed that Yeshua HaMetzi was an intermediary. And maybe we'll discuss this a little bit more at length at a different time. But just to finish off with this philo, just leave it to say that that the nephew of this philo, he ultimately, Etzachop Kishmat, and he became a bitter enemy of the Jews. And he ordered, in a generation later, for the Jewish community to be destroyed. And about 100 years later, the Jewish community just sort of, not even 100 years later, but 50 years later, the Jewish community was erased. The Jewish community of Alexandria was erased from the sea. And next time we will continue from there.